Sponsorship for this KQED live audio stream comes from Brevo, a customer relationship management platform that can help engage with clients across email, SMS, WhatsApp, and more. For more information, visit brevo.com. That's brevo.com.
From KQED in San Francisco and Public Radio International, it's Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. On today's show, violin and piano. Boring. Competitive swimming is where the thrills are for a growing number of Asian Americans. China is a suspect in the hacking of a Pentagon computer system. And what does the Burning Man Festival have to do with Asia?
You get the sense of a lot of the Buddhist and Hindu influences here when you talk to people in their camps. And the music, gosh, I mean, a lot. How can you miss that?
Pacific Time, exploring the connections between Asia, America, and our Asian American communities. Welcome to Pacific Time. I'm Juan Ha. South Koreans breathed a collective sigh of relief this week. 19 of their fellow citizens who'd been held hostage by the Taliban were finally safe at home. The group's members are Christians who say they were in Afghanistan to carry out aid work when their bus was hijacked. But they didn't receive a hero's welcome back in Korea. And their ordeal raised many questions. Did the South Korean government pay a ransom for their release? The government denies it. Their return has stirred debate over the work of Korean missionaries. Kevin Kim reports from Seoul.
As the group arrived at the airport in Seoul, they looked pale and tired. They bowed deeply in unison to the crowd of cameras and reporters. Yoo Kyung-shik is one of the 23 Christian aid workers who were held captive.
We owe an enormous debt to our country and the Korean people, and we apologize for that. My colleagues and I feel that now we have been given a second life. We promise to live our lives so that we do not let you down.
While the aid workers' lives were in danger, most South Koreans were united in their concern for them. But now that they're safe, many are questioning why they chose to go on this mission to Afghanistan in the first place, a country where they knew, being Christians, their efforts to help would not be welcomed by everyone.
I don't think it's right for people to evangelize in an aggressive way, especially in countries where they have different religions. These people went, knowing that there may be a problem.
The hostages were only released because our government negotiated with terrorists. I think there are many people here needing help. I don't think it's necessary to go abroad to evangelize.
Bae Shin-gyu's brother was a group leader and one of the two hostages killed by the Taliban in the early stages of captivity. Mr. Bae says it's been hard enough to cope with the loss of his brother, but the public criticism has made things more painful.
Many people were already doing charity work in Afghanistan, and I believe my brother would have thought thoroughly about his mission. He wasn't someone who made careless judgments. I believe he would have gone to Afghanistan thinking it was all right to go.
At this evangelical training center in Seoul, more people are preparing to go abroad. There are at least 15,000 South Korean Christian missionaries working overseas, second only to the United States. In countries where they can't serve openly as religious workers, many enter in other capacities like doctors or businessmen. But even when they're supposed to be undercover, the missionaries often attract attention by their aggressive tactics. Dr. Steve Moon is the director at the Korea Research Institute for Mission. He hopes the hostage incident will help South Korean missionaries become more thoughtful in their approach.
I think people need to prepare themselves more in terms of cultural sensitivity. We need to understand people's cultural traditions and way of life and thinking and their worldviews so that we can understand them in a deep way. Otherwise, we use some cultural norms from our own cultural background. And we need to be careful not to offend people.
자, 이 결단이 어떻게 내려집니까? 내 중심에서 하나님 중심으로 바뀝니다.
아멘. Ho Min Young preaches a Sunday sermon at this small church in Western Seoul. In 2004, Reverend Ho was on a mission trip to Iraq when he and his colleagues were kidnapped by insurgents and later freed. But he doesn't regret his decision to go.
성교는 하나님을 기쁘게 하는 것이고.
Missionary work makes God happy, and those who are called by God should go no matter what the obstacles are, even the government. If the Holy Spirit commands me, I'll go to Afghanistan or even more dangerous places, no matter what.
If other missionaries share that spirit, it will be a problem for the government. South Korea was already planning to pull its troops out of Afghanistan before the hostages were taken, but as part of the deal with the Taliban, they had to agree to keep both military and missionary forces out of the country in the future. For Pacific Time, I'm Kevin Kim in Seoul.
These days, security concerns can range from the hijacking of people to the hijacking of a computer system. In the U.S., the question is whether China's military launched a cyber attack on the Pentagon's computers in June. The Pentagon told the Financial Times newspaper this week that because of a security breach, it shut down a part of its computer network this summer. But it wouldn't say who it suspects was behind the attack. The paper quoted senior U.S. officials who point the finger at China's military, the People's Liberation Army. China has denied involvement. For more on this, I spoke with Sean Carpenter, who has worked in the Cyber Threat Analysis Division at the State Department. He's currently a forensics analyst at NetWitness. The private firm provides computer security for clients that include U.S. intelligence and national security agencies. Whether or not Beijing was involved in this recent hacking episode, Carpenter says the threat from China is significant.
In the past, there has been some very talented Chinese hacking groups that are able to come up with exploits for vulnerabilities in either operating systems or software that they're able to leverage to gain access to networks. But they've demonstrated in the past the downing of the EP3 spy plane and the subsequent cyber attacks and web-based defacements. As an example of basically hundreds of websites were defaced with political messages after that occurred.
If the hackers are sophisticated enough to attack the Pentagon, why would they leave traces that could be traced back to China?
Well, you know, a lot of times adversaries will probe other adversaries just to test the defenses and see what type of defenses their opponents are mounting. And it could well be, too, that it was a group of trainees or unskilled attackers that were not the A-team that were discovered.
Now, do you think it's a slam dunk case? I mean, is it possible to prove with certainty that, you know, the Chinese People's Liberation Army was behind this?
Well, just given the nature of cyberspace, it's often very difficult to definitively attribute activity to an individual organization. And this is especially the case when attackers use previously compromised computer systems as proxies or intermediaries to attack their real target that they're going after. And one of the other things that that's really hard for law enforcement is cyber laws are still very immature, diverse, and in some countries they're even, you know, really non-existent. So investigating sophisticated intrusions across international boundaries is just a real challenge for law enforcement. And simply looking up the IP address and determining the country of origin is pretty meaningless. On the other hand, you know, other clues, there's other pieces of the puzzle. Analyzing any malicious software that might be recovered by system forensics and trying to find information of interest within that evidence, and just observing, characterizing, and classifying your adversary's techniques that they used, tactics and procedures, and then leveraging open source and closed source research and intelligence to try to come to some conclusions.
If you watch a Hollywood action movie, you always see these fancy security systems in place, right, at the Pentagon and the State Department. They've got the thumbprint, you know, ID systems, passwords that require an eyeball match. Is that nowhere near the reality?
Well, in the example you used, like the biometric systems, and the government and large organizations are rather slow to adopt cutting edge technology because it has to be tested, especially with the government. You know, it has to undergo a lot of go through certification and accreditation processes, and it takes a while to purchase the technology. You have to include it in a bill and budgets, and you know, we're really not using the cutting edge technologies. It's just because of the nature of the government. It turns very slowly. So one other thing that I failed to mention is about that I think is really important about the responses as far as unclassified information was taken or unclassified networks. I can't emphasize enough that it really doesn't make that much sense when that is said, especially when it involves government networks. You take a look at our power distribution systems, our water treatment plants, and subsystems, other critical infrastructure systems. All of those are unclassified systems, and they use computerized SCADA devices that govern how the water is transferred, what pumps turn on. They're used in reactor plants. They're not classified, and they're just as vulnerable to attacks as other systems if they're accessible via a network. I think the whole unclassified thing is just really a cop-out.
Sean Carpenter is principal forensics analyst at the computer security firm NetWitness. The barren desert of Nevada vibrated to life last week as nearly 50,000 people flocked to Black Rock for the Burning Man Festival. It was a week full of art, music, and of course, fire. The Asian influence was apparent, but curiously, something was missing. Julie Patel went to the desert to investigate.
There were lots of Asian-inspired art projects, such as the giant dragon-shaped bus, a Taiwanese tea hour, and camps with themes such as Garaj Mahal and Ganesh.
There is a lot of Asian influence in the art and the music.
Raymond Ho, a surgical technician from Chicago, was at his 10th burn.
If anything, Burning Man is about spirituality, and I definitely think that or Asian cultures definitely contributed a lot to it. You get the sense of a lot of the Buddhist and Hindu influences here when you talk to people in their camps and stuff like that. And the music, gosh, I mean, a lot. How can you miss that? There's a ton of that. You can probably hear it in the background as we speak. So.
Burning Man organizer Megan Moulette is an anthropologist who works in Asia. She attributes some of the Eastern flavor to the hippie culture that Burning Man sprang from.
There's been an incredible amount of influence, I think, culturally from Asia in terms of philosophically through both the New Age movement but also the countercultural movement. There was a lot of visiting of Asia in the 60s that I think brought a lot of ideas to California that weren't there before.
That may help explain why Asian culture is so pervasive. But burners like Raymond Ho have another question. Where are the Asian Americans?
You would think that being near the Bay Area and a lot of, Bay Area people, that there'd be a lot more Asians. So since I don't live in the Bay Area, I don't quite understand why our community is not being represented as much.
Only 9% of attendees self-identify as people of color, although another 16% said they were sometimes, or didn't answer the question. Burning Man organizers are quick to point out that the festival is very diverse in terms of the attendees' incomes. Still, they know they'd be closer to the utopian society they're aiming for if there was more racial diversity. First-timer Kato Shue flew 8 hours from Japan after he and a friend read about Burning Man on the internet. His impression of the festival? It would never happen at home.
Very crazy event. Yeah, many people is very interesting. Japan is more not so crazy.
Maybe it's that image of Burning Man as a crazy, drug-fueled hippie fest where everyone's running around naked that turned some people off. That's a guess from Raymond Ho.
with the Asian community, there's a sense of modesty about it. The nudity part, I don't particularly contribute to that. They're probably happy about that. But I think culturally we're taught not to be like overly expressive, in at least in Chinese culture, that you know you're not supposed to go running around naked and flaunting your stuff and stuff like that. So some people get that's the impression. So, you know, what would I contribute to it? What would I gain from that here? And I think they're missing the point.
Ho said some Asians may also feel as if their culture is misappropriated.
I have a little apprehension about the way they kind of co-opt some aspects of it and not all of it, you know, and then just kind of bend it to the way that they want it to be and not really understand. I mean, I ran into the same Hong Kong flag way out there, and I was like, oh, my God, is there any people from Hong Kong? And this big white guy comes up, and he's like, no, we just like the design of the flag. And I was like, yeah, that irked me. I mean, not terribly, but I was... But, you know, you can see what I mean. It's just like, well, you're co-opting it for what? Just simply because of the design. Maybe that's kind of cool, but it was a little disappointing.
Still, the festival has grown more diverse, as evidenced by events that draw groups of Asians and Asian Americans. About a dozen people, mostly native speakers of Mandarin, gathered Friday in a so-called tea temple to sip oolong and chat. Raymond Ho said it's refreshing to see the event growing more diverse over the 10 years he's attended. And he says the best way to draw more Asians in the future is for burners like him to do a better job of representing the spirit of it when they get home.
There's no joke that Burning Man is not a spectator sport. You come here, you have to participate. And if you don't, sure, you're going to see some of the stuff that all the media talks about, but you're not going to really get it. And maybe that's kind of the thing that the Asian community and the African-American community don't understand, because there's no one bringing it back to the community and tell them, hey, look, this is what's going on.
For Pacific Time, I'm Julie Patel at Black Rock City.
Julie Patel is a reporter for the San Jose Mercury News. We've got links to her blog and photos of her adventures at Burning Man on our website, kqed.org/Pacific Time. Asian Americans have been slow to join the ranks of Little League Baseball and Pop Warner Football. But now, they're making waves in another sport. In communities with large populations of Asian Americans, a number of immigrant swim coaches from China offer expert instruction at attractive prices. As Pacific Times' Larissa Zhou finds out, a growing number of private swim schools now cater to Asian American youth.
Fremont High School's pool deck is a popular hangout for Silicon Valley's Asian American families. Parents chat with each other on the canopied bleachers. Kids make a ruckus as they chase each other around the deck. But once they dive into the water, it's down to business. Coach Joe Jung begins this class with an 8-lap warm-up. The kids, mostly 8-year-olds, push off right in sync with Jung's whistle. They then rotate through the 4 basic strokes, working on kicking and arms. For a whole hour, they go back and forth across the pool. Swimming isn't an easy sport, and this isn't an easy workout. But there are no complaints. Jung's strict coaching actually lured Bob Sharma and his daughter Supriya to Panda Swimming School.
He's got pretty intense training, and he keeps an eye on the kids. Any little mistake, he corrects them right away. Little things... See, once you learn how to swim, and then he fine-tunes it and makes a little adjustment with the kids, kind of refines everything.
The San Francisco Bay Area is the adopted home of several former Chinese swim stars like Jung, who came to the U.S. to pursue graduate studies. They coached on the side, and many wound up opening private swimming schools. One coach used to swim for the Chinese national team. Another won a silver medal at the Barcelona Olympics. Besides the reputation, these Chinese coaches offer plenty of classes to fit into parents' schedules, and above all, they focus on excellence. Parent James Liu says this isn't always the focus at other swimming institutions.
The problem why SMA, their purpose is different. You look at Joe's class, they teach basic skills, and the coach is quite strict. If they're doing something wrong, they're going to correct right away and make sure they are doing the right thing. And the YMCA, the purpose, I think is different. The most important for them is have fun. They have team together, weekend, have fun. That's it.
News spread by word of mouth. Zhang's school started 5 years ago with around 100 students. Now he and two assistants teach 500 to 600 kids in 44 sessions throughout the week. According to Zhang, swimming is now the it sport for Asian kids.
But over the last couple of years, kind of like swimming, piano, or painting, that becomes kind of like a must for every family, Asian China family. And whatever reason, if you don't have talent, you have to learn. It's kind of like it becomes like, if you learn, I have to learn.
According to figures provided by the National Governing Body for Competitive Swimming, membership for Asian and Pacific Islanders in the Northern California and Nevada region quadrupled in the last 8 years. This rising popularity can be observed at the national level, too. While overall membership has only gone up 14%, Asian and Pacific Islander competitive swimming increased by more than 200%. It's a particularly busy day at Fremont High School. Serious swimming is all about speed, and today is the swimming portion of the Taiwanese and Chinese American Athletic Tournament. Six-year-old Colleen Lee received so many medals that she and her mother couldn't keep track of them all.
This is breaststroke, and these are freestyle and breaststroke too.
Backstroke.
Yeah.
And while Colleen's parents make sure that the video recorder is turned on every time she goes up to claim a medal, they have very realistic expectations. Colleen's mother seems to enjoy the atmosphere at the bustling pool as much as she likes the competition itself.
It's, for example, for me, I just want her like practice and for her body, it's good for her health. That's the main point. As for the competition, I don't expect anything because I know after a while it's just for the Asian people, no way to get anything.
She's referring to the Asian physique, one that is typically smaller and not as muscly as Caucasian body types. Coach Zhang says that Asian kids may excel in the pool early on because of their petite, more flexible frame, but they often plateau during their teenage years, when muscle bulk and pure strength are essential to improving speed. The Asian work ethic, he adds, often exacerbates the problem. Swimming emphasizes repetition and practice, but Zhang has witnessed many cases of parents who push their children too hard too early. The kids break records as 8- or 9-year-olds, but burn out by the time they become teenagers. So far, 6-year-old Colleen only takes lessons at Panda Swimming School. Eventually, if she and her parents are serious enough, she'll join a competitive swim club, like Roslyn Liu did. 9-year-old Roslyn has already broken records that are older than she is. And her father, James Liu, says her goal is to be in the Olympics.
As a parent, I want to quit because there's so much commitment. But she likes so much, I kind of feel guilty to quit.
Liu says that if Roslyn doesn't have what it takes to be a champion, that's okay. But for now, while she still has the swimming bug, her dad will stand quietly at the side of the pool, cheering her on. For Pacific Time, this is Larissa Zhou in Sunnyvale, California.
And some final notes on what else is making news in Asia and Asian America. The families of Japanese soldiers who fought during World War II are campaigning for a postal stamp to honor them. An online petition is underway, as well as a letter-writing campaign to the U.S. Postal Service. The 442nd Regimental Combat Team was the most decorated unit in American history. The soldiers were second-generation Japanese Americans who served with unusual bravery, even though their families were interned by the U.S. government. An amateur boxing medalist will be South Korea's first astronaut. Ko San, who's also an aerospace engineer, was picked from a field of 36,000 applicants. He'll conduct tests at the International Space Station next year. The launch will make South Korea only the 6th Asian country to put a person in space. And watch out, England! An armada of 29,000 Chinese-made rubber duckies. turtles and frogs are floating toward the British Isles. The toys fell out of a shipping container into the Pacific 15 years ago. Since then, they've been sighted locked in Alaskan glaciers and on the beaches of Hawaii. No word on whether the Royal Navy is prepared to counter the amphibious landing. It's time for my rubber ducky and me to run off to our next adventure. Our theme music was composed by Anthony Brown with the Asian American Orchestra. Visit us on the web at kqed.org/pacific time. Got a story idea or want to share your rubber ducky's photos? Email us, pacifictime@kqed.org. Our staff includes Nina Thorson, Wink Weeduk, Seal Muller, Mina Kim, Lita Martinez, Larissa Zoe, Helen Lee, Howard Gelman, and Raul Ramirez. I'm Juan Ha. Thanks for tuning in.
Funds for the production of Pacific Time are provided by the Freeman Foundation, Matthews International Capital Management, a San Francisco-based advisor investing in the future of Asia since 1994, the Wallace Alexander Gerbode Foundation, and the KQED Campaign for the Future Program Venture Fund.
PRI, Public Radio International.